WBUR. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. After months of hype, the curtain has finally been drawn on inventor Dean Kamen's highly anticipated and highly secretive project, Ginger. The Segway human transporter, Kamen says, will revolutionize the way we think about transportation, energy, and urban planning. Amy Harmon is a technology reporter for the New York Times who's been watching the story of Ginger for a while. I asked her why there's been so much hype around the invention.
Well, partly because of the provocative details that leaked out in January. There was a book proposal that got a $250,000 book contract, which is a lot, from Harvard Business School Press, that included certain details about the invention and certain things that people like Steve Jobs apparently said that it was, you know, could be bigger than the personal computer. And people began speculating sort of hysterically, really, on the internet and elsewhere. In this book proposal, it was referred to just as it.
And now that we've seen it, does it live up to the speculation and anticipation?
Well, it's not a hovercraft, so it's going to be a letdown. You know, it doesn't let you fly around in your own personal transportation pod like the Jetsons did. So in that sense, it doesn't live up to the hype. On the other hand, it's a really interesting technology. It has a very unique balancing mechanism so that you can stand on it, and it's called the Segway, mm-hmm. So we don't have to call it it.
Right.
But and you lean forward a little bit, and it moves, and you lean back, and it slows down.
Have you been on one, Amy, yourself?
I have been on one.
And what's it feel like?
It's cool. It doesn't really feel like anything that I've been on before.
We've all seen the Razor scooters in the last couple of years. Is it like that?
Yeah, it's nothing like that, mm-hmm. because you don't have to have a sense of balance yourself. And that's what they are hoping, Dean Kamen and his company is hoping, that it will fill this niche between walking and driving that hasn't been filled by these devices like a scooter or a bicycle or, you know, the Razors, because you don't have to do any work. You just stand on it, and you sort of think, well, I want to go over there, and it takes you there.
So if you were a child who had never learned how to ride a bike, or if you were elderly and uncertain of your balance, would you still feel comfortable on this device?
I think you would. I think, you know, it takes about 3 minutes to feel comfortable, and it is unique in that way. Now, whether it makes sense for it to go on sidewalks, which is what it's designed to do, mm-hmm. Is another question. You know, I tried it on an unobstructed track, you know, in their headquarters in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Not an obstacle course on Fifth Avenue.
No. And, you know, Fifth Avenue will probably be the last place they say that you know, they will not target heavily cities like New York with heavily congested sidewalks. It's more suited for places with you know, wide pedestrian paths or even bike paths, or, you know, they hope eventually that cities will actually build lanes just for this device.
And what is the inventor's big vision of how this might change our energy use and travel patterns, habits?
Well, I mean, the idea is that, you know, they did a study where they found that people don't walk more than 15 minutes. You know, if they're going to have to go more than 15 minutes, mm-hmm. they'll jump in a cab or they'll take a car. You know, many people drive just a few miles from their home to their work because there's no, you know, good public transportation and there's no real, you know, a good way to go unless they walk or ride a bike, which they don't want to do to go to work.
Because they arrive sweaty and there's nowhere to put the bike or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. And they have to ride in the street with the traffic, mm-hmm. which is dangerous. Mm-hmm. So their idea is that this could be something that, you know, that the world has never had before, where you can go on a sidewalk and you don't have to worry about balance and you don't have to be sort of athletic to do it. And it will induce people to use something that doesn't use oil, that doesn't, you know, this can go 15 miles on a 6-hour charge. You plug it into the wall, which is about a dime's worth of electricity. Mm-hmm. And it will just encourage people to go somewhere without their cars farther than they ever would before.
Would you take it to work, Amy?
Well, again, I live in New York, so it would be more, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine it on a New York sidewalk. If there was a lane for it, I would. Yeah, I live a mile from my work, mm-hmm. and I often walk. I do walk,
right.
But sometimes I take the subway,
right.
And I think I would take the subway less if I had one of these.
So what are the first applications likely to be?
Well, what they're doing, and they're very concerned that this not be seen as a toy. you know, or as something that for, you know, adolescents to zip around on, because they really want it to be seen as a productivity tool, something that adults will use. So they
good luck
are,
to them keeping it away from adolescents zipping it around.
Yes, they are. They're
good luck.
They're limiting it at first to trials where postal workers are going to use it in their two trials starting in January, because the post office thinks that they might be able to save money on trucks mm-hmm. and allow their carriers to go much farther, you know, in less time. And they actually say that they can attach carts to the back of them, and that's another site where they're going to start being used. Is Amazon.com is going to use a couple in their warehouses to see if they can save money by, you know, the employees have to zip around these large spaces and corporate campuses as well.
And did I read something about that? Was it the Park Service or City of Atlanta is going to use it?
Yes, both the Park Service are going to put rangers on it in a test trial, and the City of Atlanta wants to use it at first with they have a volunteer police force that patrols the downtown area, and then they're interested in trying to roll it out to actual citizens. Thousands of people drive 4 miles, you know, every day mm-hmm. to their office, and they're hoping to get people to use these instead.
The average speed is supposed to be about 8 miles an hour. What does that feel like? Faster than walking? Slower than running?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you walk maybe a mile in 20 minutes or half an hour, mm-hmm. so it's about three times walking speed. You're gliding along, and which makes it kind of fun, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you commuting to it one day, Amy. Can you see cities full of these someday, the Segway universe?
You know, I watched a lot of Jetsons when I was growing up, so, you know, yeah, I can.
Amy Harmon is a technology reporter for The New York Times. After a year of hype and hoopla, the project known as It, then Ginger, has now been unveiled as the Segway human transporter. It looks like a cross between an old rotary lawnmower and a Razor scooter. It doesn't fly, it doesn't hover. In fact, it only reaches speeds of 17 miles an hour, tops. But already the City of Atlanta, the National Park Service, several police departments, and online bookseller Amazon.com has signed on to test and use the Segway. This hour, we're going to take a look at the Segway and the larger role of innovation and technology in a post-September 11th world. Joining me by telephone is David Sagansky, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Welcome, David Sagansky.
Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
We're also joined by our news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, David Sagansky, you're all over the world of invention and innovation, and we have one of the most high-profile inventions I can remember in years that came into the light of public scrutiny today. What do you think of the Segway human transporter?
Well, when I first saw it this morning, I was a little bit overwhelmed. But as I began to think about it, when I saw how naturally people were taking to it, the possibilities really began to bubble up.
Do you mean you were overwhelmed or underwhelmed?
I was originally underwhelmed. When the curtain went up and we saw a scooter, I thought, I thought it was going to be more than this. But
yeah.
I didn't realize it really was more.
Well, tell us, what is it that we might not see at first blush?
I really think it pours gas on America's need for speed, efficiency, effectiveness, excitement, sport, all rolled into one. It's like eight-cylinder walking.
Well, that's pretty great. Dean Kamen, the inventor, has a big vision for what this might mean. He said, you know, it will wean us from oil dependence. It will cause cities to be redesigned. It will compress time and space for pedestrians, raise productivity for corporations and government agencies. Can you see American society adopting this aid to walking in a way that would do all that?
I think all those good things can only happen if there's a little extra punch to it. There's something fascinating about it. It's like a vacation on wheels. You don't have to do any work. When you combine that with good stuff, then the whole package works.
The people we saw riding around on it on television this morning certainly looked delighted doing it. But then just being delighted by something, I mean, we're delighted by a hula hoop, but it doesn't move you anywhere.
That's right. But, you know, I heard on the piece that just preceded us, Amy Harmon said that they don't want it to be a toy. But I think that's what makes it the best toy of all.
Of course, they don't get to decide if it's a toy or not. They're not putting it out as a toy. They're not marketing it that way. What it's got something, a speed range of 5 to 17 miles per hour. And Amy described that as something between walking and running. Does that sound like a speed that people are going to feel comfortable with on crowded sidewalks, David Sagansky?
Well, you know, I think people are comfortable entertaining themselves with that speed. I mean, people buy jet skis and they buy skidoos just to get that feeling, and now they can have that feeling without getting wet or cold. I think that in terms of using them on the sidewalks, if you look at some of the original writings in the scientific literature at the turn of the century, mm-hmm. it was predicted that automobiles would never be drivable at above 20 miles an hour because the human was incapable of controlling any vehicle moving at that speed.
Right. We have surpassed that. Of course, we've built about $100,000 trillion worth of infrastructure to make those automobiles so usable.
Yeah, but what it comes down to is that your body is capable of adjusting to all sorts of challenges. And when you know the first time you hop on a motorcycle, you know you're going to fall off. But pretty soon your body adjusts to it. From what I saw, how natural this device works, people were using it immediately. I have no doubt that within 5 minutes, people are going to be doing ballets on the street and not bumping into each other.
Talk to us about the technology behind this. Now, why would a gyroscope make the steering so intuitive and almost like just willing it with your mind? And also, why would it make it so stable and you know so that it doesn't topple over?
Well, a gyroscope is the basic mechanism that we use to figure out where up is, for instance, in an airplane. Mm-hmm. A pilot looks at a gyroscopic instrument, a little artificial horizon, and as long as he keeps that straight and level to his eyes, he knows his airplane is straight and level.
Mm-hmm.
The automatic pilot gets rid of the pilot. It throws in a computer to do the same thing. That's what the Segway has. It actually watches a gyro. You can think of it as a child's top spinning on, say, a plate. If you tip the plate, mm-hmm. the top still points up.
So if I lean, it's going to compensate for my lean.
Exactly. In fact, what it's going to do is it's going to keep that platform very, very close to horizontal at all times. You're not going to fall off of it. It's electronically controlled to remain in a fixed orientation. You're just not going to get tipped.
And how does the steering seem to read my mind, where I want to go, which direction?
Think about the bicycle. I'm sure you can picture how hard it would be to control a unicycle, but you know that when you're on a bicycle, this magic feedback thing happens. You just want to go in a certain direction, and you don't consciously turn that wheel. In fact, if you really yanked it and turned it, you'd go flying, but it just goes where you want it to go.
Jack Beatty, are you going to be the first guy on whisking down the streets of Vermont and New Hampshire on your new Segway human transporter?
No, and it's partly because of the declivity of those streets that I'm not going to be doing this. You know, play this across the U.S. cities. Can you imagine this in San Francisco with those hills? No way. Los Angeles, where people have to drive, you know, 12 miles to get a newspaper? Not likely. Chicago, downtown, but you got the weather. Seattle, hilly. So that you have all these sort of geographic.
Now, Jack, you're picking all the toughest spots here.
I am picking. I'm not bringing in Indianapolis.
How about Tampa?
Tampa. And then just more fundamentally, this is like, you know, inventing the steam engine, the boiler, a locomotive, but having no place to put it. I mean, and I talked to an expert friend of mine, an inventor today, who said, you know, the problem here is the access problem. You got to have a third place for these things. They can't go on the sidewalk. That's mayhem for the pedestrian. They can't go on the street. That's mayhem for the guy on the scooter. You got to have a third place, which means we need something like the equivalent of the infrastructure, the railroad tracks that made the steam engine a technologically and culturally and historically significant piece of technology.
Oh boy, what comes next? The Jetson Skyways.
Yeah.
We're talking tonight about the Segway human transporter, today's big announcement of the new invention. And more broadly, we'll talk about how technology and technological innovation can affect the world. It has in the past. Jack Beatty just mentioned a couple, the railroad. Think about how the car and television. What are we looking at down the road that may change the way we think the world will work? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you make of the Segway human transporter? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the new Segway human transporter, the Jetsons Mobile. Looks like a lawnmower, rides like a dream, they say. Have you tried one yet? Will you plunk down $3,000 a year from now to be the first on your block to have one? And at a larger scale, what can we expect from technological innovation in changing the face of our assumptions about the world? Maybe things will be different than we expect. We're joined by David Sagansky. He's professor of electrical and computer engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And now by Thomas Fry, CEO of the Da Vinci Institute, a futurist think tank that explores new technologies. Good evening, Thomas Fry.
Howdy. How are you doing, Tom?
We're well. Thanks very much for joining us. I should give our number out. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Will the Segway human transporter change the world or just your world in ways that matter or not? Call us. Thomas Fry, you look at big trends in technology, the impact of innovation and how it affects society, how society responds. Place this one. Here we are on day one of its public life. How do you think it's going to rank? And more than that, as you've looked out at the world through this fall of crisis and woe, are there technologies coming on stream that may actually be part of the solution? That's a big, broad range of questions there. Forgive me.
But let me start by saying that I think that this is a product that defines a new category in transportation. And I was asking myself this question earlier today. I was asking the question, this is the biggest innovation in transportation since the invention of what? And I haven't quite placed that yet.
Hmm. So the options would be train, car, plane,
motorcycle.
All right.
Golf car.
Okay. Well, that brings us right down to earth. Biggest thing since the golf cart.
Maybe. I don't know. It's... Once people start interacting with this device, I believe that they're going to start inventing new uses for it. I can think of dozens of uses for it right off the top of my head.
What comes to mind?
Everything from using it in warehouses to working with handicapped people to using it in amusement parks to malls to there's lots of big venues around the United States here. Mm. And whenever you get in these big venues, people tend to wear out. Mm-hmm. If you're going to a convention and you're walking up and down the aisles, you wear out, and so you stop.
Of course, all those would be novel and cool, but this innovation will not really make a difference in our energy consumption, in our urban design, unless it is adopted at a mass scale or something approaching that. What determines whether a new technology gets that mass adoption or not, Thomas Fry?
We go back to the idea of what's the purpose of an invention. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of an invention, the definition for that we use is the purpose of an invention is to improve the ability, capability, or environment of human beings.
Okay.
And it's always interesting to tag in there that it's for human beings. Now, this has... The focus of most inventions is that that we're looking for ways to improve our ability to see farther, hear better, run faster, jump higher. This improves our ability to move farther than we have in the past. It adds some sort of a power source to our ability to walk. It replaces walking in a lot of sense. I believe that. That will occur. I think the price point of $3,000 will work its way down over a couple of years to something under $1,000, making it pretty accessible for most people.
Of course, Dean Kamen, the inventor, says that it's not walking he wants to replace, but the big automobile that he sees people using to get just short distances around urban areas. He says, charmingly or not, in today's Time magazine, it makes no sense at all for people in cities to use a 4,000-pound piece of metal to haul their 150-pound asses around town. It looks like the car is what he's aiming at, Thomas Fry.
Yeah, the visions of the inventor are seldom the visions of consumers. I believe that this is going to end up being used in lots of ways that he never envisioned. Mm. And the idea of of replacing walking makes much more sense to me than replacing a car. Now, I believe that later versions of this will make it more weather adaptable, so it can be rode around on the streets in maybe in icy conditions and bad weather. It's raining outside and the mud, all of those things.
We make it a hood. We make it a windshield. Thomas Fry, stand by. We have callers that want to join the conversation. We're talking about the Segway Human Transporter unveiled today and more broadly about technological innovation and its impact on society, sometimes unexpected impacts. Can technology help us out of the current global jam we're in? Can it wean us from oil, from pollution, from war? What's the next big thing you're waiting on? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Al is on the line. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guests have touched on most of what I wanted to talk about, but I wanted to stress a couple of points. One was the price of this right now is going to prevent these Segway hoodlums from roaming the sidewalks, which I think is something you talked a little bit about.
It's more than a skateboard. They say the industrial version will sell for about $8,000 and maybe a year from now $3,000 for consumers. That's not something your typical eighth grader will shell out, I guess.
Exactly. And that sounds to me like half the price of a car to live in the city. And remember, living in the city, you know, you got to do and what are you going to do as far as insurance, all that you need to have for the car. So that's one thing I think is important. Boston has a great public transit system, but even some people have to take the T, then take a bus, and then walk some distance. So I see those people taking a Segway.
So, Al, how about for you personally? At what price point would you grab one of these things, and would you use it to commute?
Yes, I would. I think if I was one of those people with a difficult commute that I just described, or if I lived in Concord, New Hampshire, which really doesn't have the same transportation that Boston does, a city like that, which is growing more, so the traffic has become more of a problem. And I think if trails like the Independence Trail or the Minuteman Trail, I'm trying to think of, that has a bad crossing at Porter Square in Cambridge, this kind of system would probably make appropriate a bridge over Porter Square or a tunnel underneath for that one section of what is otherwise a really good trail.
You know, Al, I was thinking earlier today that this is an innovation, like so many piggyback on earlier infrastructures. This ought to piggyback on all the ramps that have been built for the handicapped over the last decade and more. It's perfect for the Segway human transporter. Up you go, right up the ramp, huh?
Absolutely. The other thing I wanted to touch on real quickly was, unfortunately, some people would rather not walk 10 feet. They'd rather wait in their car 10 minutes for a spot to open up closest to the door so they can go into the mall. Excuse me. But I think this kind of device could make a city more planned better around parks and walking areas so that even though you're going to get some person walk out of one store, take it 20 feet to the next door, you're going to get these common spaces where the car is less of a focus and more of it is pathways. And I think that might, in fact, do what they say, revolutionize this.
That would sure be welcome. Al, thanks for your call. David Sagansky, they say that this the transporter weighs 65 or 80 pounds, depending on the model. That's a little heavy for slinging in and out of your trunk at the mall, isn't it?
I agree with you, but I think what will happen is the people who are going to adopt it are the people who are going to go straight from their house or straight from their place of business to their usual haunts. It's an extension of our desire to be individual. If it means one less jump onto a public transport, because now instead of the bus, I can hop onto my Segway, that's what's going to happen. There's something very cultural about the Segway. I think it only could happen in America, and I think that's where the adoption is going to be very, very rapid.
Jack Beatty, here we are again, America, the global early adopter of new technologies. Where do you put this in? Does it fit somewhere in the timeline of inventions, or does it bring to mind any thoughts about inventions that have come to us in times of crisis?
Well, I mean, the last big invention that came in a time of crisis was the atomic bomb in World War II that sort of put an end to World War II.
A bit different scale from the human transporter, maybe.
Different scale indeed to this sort of thing. I like what David Sagansky said, that in some ways this is culturally appropriate, individualism, and then it may even be appropriate to this moment of history. People are frightened of public transportation, I suppose, in the age of terrorism. So I could see that. But, you know, I have a kind of outside look at this and just a sort of Luddite view, which is that if I were an official of the American Heart Association listening to this discussion. I would listen to what Mr. Fry said. It's going to replace walking. By gosh, you know, according to studies, something like a third of Americans are obese. Their lives are threatened. Their longevity is limited by this. And walking, every doctor says, is the only way, serious way, integrate walking into your daily life that people can begin to make their hearts efficient.
But Jack, they say this will carry a 250-pound passenger plus a 70-pound cargo. That's a lot of donuts on the side. I mean, you can be obese and still ride it, I guess.
Well, that's the point. People are going to be riding it, and they're not going to be walking. And, you know, in the malls and every place else, and we're going to have – in other words, that's going to accentuate, I think, probably one of the worst trends of our whole society, this trend toward excess weight that bedevils us all.
David, is that you, David?
Yes, I was going to say, can I just toss in what my wife said this morning when
Please?
I told her I wanted one?
Yes.
She said, I'm sure you do. It'll give you more time to jog.
Right. David Zagansky, help us broaden this conversation a little bit. We want to get at the point of how innovations come into our world and change expectations about the future. You've just been at a conference, I know, thinking about the next 100 years of invention. We tend to think in a linear way. Things are X today, they'll be X tomorrow, and therefore we have the same old problems to deal with. But do you anticipate a continuing stream of innovations that will change the reality that we're looking out at in some fundamental ways?
I think every study that has been done shows that innovation simply speeds the next innovation. We've been accelerating for hundreds of years, and it's going to continue to accelerate. And the things that make innovation come about the fastest are enablers of innovation. And I see this product as one of those things. What made the Internet become what the Internet has become mm-hmm. is the fact that it didn't have any purpose by itself. It was a tool that you could use, and it opened your imagination, and people dreamt of new ways of applying it. I think this device doesn't by itself have a use, but you start people thinking and saying, well, I could do this with it. I can now bring it into my business and achieve the following efficiency, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think about innovation and the way it might change your life, change the way you walk or don't walk? Walt is on the line. Welcome, Walt. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
I got two comments I'd like to make. One is regarding utility, and the other is a safety issue.
Now, bring them on.
As far as utility is concerned, if you recall reading that the business community in America back in the 1800s was absolutely certain that this newfangled gadget called a telephone would have absolutely no place in business. It's just a toy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that comment. I think we have
And yet it has kind of a place in our lives these days.
Moderately so. In fact, the instrument we're talking on right now is the toy.
Yeah.
Now, the other issue is, so anyway, and to follow that up, it's a question of, as the man that just preceded me, there's going to be innovation based on new applications. I think this one's a keeper.
As David Zagansky says, all right, so it's a keeper, and it may be more to it than we think now. Your next point.
The other one was safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 65-pound machine, was thereabouts, whistling around the streets. And it, to my point of view, it's no more dangerous than a bicycle, which is everywhere, urban, suburban,
mm-hmm.
rural. It's everywhere, sidewalks,
mm-hmm.
streets, alleys. It's just another two-wheel device that's self-propelled rather than man-propelled.
So you'd welcome it. To Jack Beatty's point about fitness, of course, the inventor says it's not for the kind of walks people take today. It's to get people to go further without using their car, to get them to go several miles without using their car.
Further and quicker, yeah.
Do you think it will have a dilatory effect on people's fitness?
No, I think that I do walking every day, too, and mm-hmm. I think that comes from a different source. You don't go on a walk to get someplace. It's like doing push-ups. Your net progress is zero. You're going up and down. That's a utilitarian thing that you do that because you like to or you should do it.
This
is transportation, not exercise, and I think they have different places in our lives, driven by different things.
We got it. Walt, thanks very much for your call. Thomas Fry, there you go. The postmodern world is upon us. You don't walk to get places, our caller Walt says. And in a way, he's right these days. People walk when they're ready to exercise. But put this, if you will, in a bigger context for us. How do you see this onward, ceaseless flow of innovation? Will it change the world in ways that lead us to solutions we may not see or expect now that seem to be piled up around us on every side, the problems we're facing?
One of the things we have here at the Da Vinci Institute is we have a list of over 100 of what we call immortalizer technologies. These are the big things that haven't been invented yet.
The immortalizers, cool.
Yeah, we call them immortalizer technologies because the person that invents them, their name will become immortal. It'll live on forever.
Okay, what are we waiting for?
Tons of things. We're learning how to control human aging and learning how to control gravity. And there's 100 other items that we could go into.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at all of the news that was broadcast today, mm-hmm. all of that news is very transitory. But inventing something like this takes us to another level. This is a permanent change in humankind. This advances the knowledge that we have as a species,
mm-hmm.
and advances our culture. This is a permanent change, a permanent ratcheting up of society. That's what inventions do. That's unlike other things that happen in our world. Inventions permanently change the way we live.
Point taken. But today, there's been a lot of ambivalence about some of the inventions of the 20th century in a sense that a good number have been applied in ways that we wish they weren't and that might have made life worse. Now we see poverty, we see population explosion and resource shortage. Can innovation keep up with the tide of demands presented by the very humans it's supposed to serve?
There's always a downside to technology. You talked about the fact that people will be riding this and not walking, so then therefore they'll get fat and obese. A certain percentage of the population, that's true. That'll happen with a certain percentage of the population. You can't think through all of the possibilities of a new technology. Some of the things I was thinking about with this is, is government going to get in and require licensing for these devices?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of body of law are we going to have come into place that requires us to drive these things on certain services but not on others?
Mm-hmm. Stay off my lawn.
Yeah, and then what kind of insurance is required? If somebody is driving this and they run into a wall, the accidents that you can have, is it going to be required to have an airbag on it? All kinds of odd things will happen over the next 5 to 10 years regarding this one particular invention.
All the protocol, the etiquette, the regulatory paradise that this could produce.
Oh, yeah.
Thomas Fry, I want to thank you very much for being with us this hour. It's been great having you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thomas Fry is CEO of the Da Vinci Institute, a futurist think tank that explores new technologies. Jack Beatty, are you going to be first in line to get your license for the human transporter?
I don't know about the vision test. Moving along at 8 miles an hour.
yep. Read this sign. We're talking about technology, today's announcement of the Segway human transporter, and the broader ways in which innovations suddenly drop into our world and change our world. What do you think? Can technology help us out of some of the global jams we're in? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the unveiling today of the Segway human transporter and, on a larger scale, how human innovation interacts with many, many aspects of human lives. Sometimes changes history, the future, in ways we don't anticipate. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think? Can this new little invention wean us from oil, from pollution, from war? And what's the next big thing that you're waiting on? We're joined now by Arthur Malella. He's director of the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation at the Smithsonian Institute. Good evening, Arthur Malella.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We're using the unveiling today of this gyro scooter to talk more broadly about innovation and invention and how it patterns and, I guess, and impacts of technology innovation. You watch this professionally from the Smithsonian. What do you see as the focus of the energies of innovators and inventors these days? Are there big areas that where you see a lot of energy being focused?
Sure. I only saw this morning on the morning shows, But it seems to me that this is embodying some of the leading edge areas of technology today, the use of the microprocessor, for example. That's something that wasn't evident from simply looking at it.
Couldn't make it all work without that.
You couldn't, and that's clearly at the cutting edge of things. And the I'm sure there's some innovative uses of gyroscopes in this. There are gyroscopes, but maybe an innovative way of doing that. And those are two very interesting areas of technology. There may be material technologies, too, that, again, I'd have to see, look at this more completely to understand that. But I think this probably embodies some of those technologies.
Arthur Malella, put it in a context of historical patterns for us. Does innovation, of course, the work on this long predated September 11th, but yet we're trying to look across time here, and does innovation increase or decrease in times of crisis, in times of war in American history?
Well, there's no question that wars have stimulated innovations, or the direction of innovation was certainly shifted by wars in American history. And it's no surprise that in wartime, governments have looked to the inventing community to, you know, freelance inventors to help them out. But if you look at something like World War One, there certainly was a stimulation of explosive chemistry and airplanes. And World War Two. It was already mentioned. You had the atomic bomb, a nuclear power, and TV, antibiotics. Computing was certainly accelerated by World War II. So you can make a case for crises like this stimulating new technologies, though the technologies don't always behave the way you predict.
On the other hand, we've heard about the famous drought of venture capital in the last year as the dot-com boom went bust. This product has a lot of venture money in it, including $38 million from Kleiner Perkins, the big Silicon Valley venture capital outfit. John Doerr, the leading light there, says this will be the fastest company in history to reach $1 billion in sales. That's a lot of scooters. But what do you think about where we're placed nationally right now, Arthur Malella, in terms of supporting innovation? We went through a big surge in the 90s, but are we on the cusp of a lot of activity there, or is this a dry spell?
Well, it's hard to say. The last 6 months have been pretty depressing in terms of these kinds of technologies. Does this signal something new? My basic feeling is that you have a period of euphoria with technologies, and I think the speculative bubble with the dot-coms was an example of that. But that doesn't mean that the underlying technology is drying up necessarily, because I still see a massive acceleration in those technologies. I think public attitudes change toward it, and those public attitudes are registered on the stock market pretty quickly. So I think the jury's still out on whether the technologies have plateaued or not. It's not clear to me they have. I think there's still an acceleration going on. And what it takes is, you know, perhaps something like this to kind of stimulate a new sense of public confidence in it.
But historically, that urge to innovate and invent has been a hallmark of American culture. Did you say there's a school of thought that sees that diminishing?
I think it's always been a part of our sense of self in America. Our very identity is linked up with invention. We thought of ourselves from the very start as an innovative country, politically, socially, and that went along with an adoption of invention that's always been with us. So there's a certain technological enthusiasm that's part of our character. And I think, looking at September 11th, there was a sense that maybe technologies that we had invented, most of these were starting to get out of control and they were falling down on us all around us. And this this technology, from what I can tell, kind of has an individual small is beautiful flavor to it that may mark a, you know, shift in direction, or at least a way for us to emerge from some of our depression about.
Well, certainly not. It's not a grandiose technology. It's not a 757 or a 100-story tower.
Yeah, there's some beauty in that.
Arthur Malella, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Arthur Malella is director at the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation at the Smithsonian Institute. What about that, Jack Beatty? Do you see some beauty in the small is beautiful kind of a thing we've had unveiled today?
Well, I like that. I mean, it's away from the sort of brutalist inventions, you know, the big mega this and mega that. And this fits in with the computer age of the portable computer. And
the portable everything.
Portable everything. And certainly that fits into that. I still think, though, that it's important to look at the role of innovation. But historically, in this country, it has also required the public sector to make innovation tell significantly. And this is going to take the public sector to make it tell significantly by creating alternative ways for this, mm-hmm. these things to get around.
Or to really blossom.
Yeah. And then ironically enough, you know, we're talking about this just at the time when people are saying, well, we're going to pull the plug on Amtrak, which is, you know, an old technology, but whose effect on energy consumption is so much more important and dramatic than this new invention appears to be today.
A million.
And yet it may be that Amtrak will be abolished because it can't turn a profit.
Jack, let's get a couple more callers in.
Okay.
Rudy's on the line. Welcome, Rudy. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
This follows with the last comment that was made. I mean, I'm all for new technological innovation, but I'm wondering if we've taken existing transport technologies to their true meaningful end. I mean, what happens to the bicycle? I haven't really seen what's been described today on TV, but it sounds as though it's sort of a bicycle, isn't it?
Well, it's a bicycle, but you don't have to pedal. I mean, I guess in utility it's a bicycle, except it takes the human effort out of it. You know, you get a one-hour charge for 2 hours of operation, and off you go. No sweating required.
Right. I wonder, though, if a new innovation shouldn't be things like bike paths, which were never really taken to their meaningful end, and whether instead we're replacing it with something else.
Well, it's an interesting point. Rudy, thanks for your call. David Sagansky, what about that? I mean, the claims made for this device you might make for the bicycle. It'll take you farther than walking with less effort, and yet there's limits to what we've done with bicycle riding. Or is it that in innovation, tiny little degrees of convenience and difference can make a real big difference in adoption?
I think what this has over the bicycle, you already put your finger on, which is the fact that it doesn't require any effort. In fact, doesn't require any skill on the part of the user. It requires much less in the way of preparation of the track underneath it, so to speak. The demonstrations we saw today had it going over rough materials and even jumping down steps. I think what this does is takes the bicycle and brings it into the 21st century, strangely enough.
And maybe to Jack Beatty's point about it being, why don't we just use trains, there's also something about Americans that goes for the individual transport system.
That's exactly what it is.
The individual everything, huh?
The personal computer, the cell phone that you can take anywhere with yourself rather than using a pay phone someplace. The fact that we are such a automotive country, you don't find that in other countries. In fact, we all want our own home on our own piece of property, even if it's a postage stamp. We are a country of individualists.
Sometimes you wonder if technology keeps us from making changes that might be good for us.
Well, I'm sure there's a large number of people who feel exactly that way. On the other hand, it's this individualism that fuels the innovation, as I think it was Jack pointed out earlier. In order to drive innovation like this, you need a lot of cash. That cash is not going to come from somebody necessarily making a sensible long-term decision. It's going to come from lots and lots of individuals being inspired and all wanting their own.
David Sagansky, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
David Sagansky is professor of electrical and computer engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Great to have you, David. Jack Beatty, well, there you've got it. The private and the public, the collective and the individual, all of America in a scooter.
Yeah, and this is a mode of transportation that doesn't seem to be at war with the biosphere, which can't be said for the 20th century innovations, the automobile, the airplane, and so on. So this is going in the right direction. I mean, if we could have cars that operated as with similar efficiency, and you know, we're on the way there with hybrid engines and so on. But this is a kind of transportation that is environmentally friendly, and at a time when people say we're approaching, you know, we have cheap energy today, but there's a piece in the Times on Sunday that said, oh boy, as soon as 2000 2010, we're going to have energy scarcity. And by the way, Saudi Arabia is not a stable country. This could happen tomorrow. And there we are in our SUVs.
Our SUV is good.
Yeah. And, this is saying, hey, folks, get out of that SUV and get on your scooter and do the shopping that way. I like that idea. I like the idea of an environmentally friendly form of transportation.
Jack, I have a picture in my mind, and it's you on a scooter headed off for some environmentally in purpose. I don't know what environmentally friendly purpose. We'll see.
Jack, I'll have an American flag.
Oh, yeah, waving high. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And happy scooting. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, something on the persistence and peril of memory. When Osama bin Laden addressed the world by videotape shortly after the War on Terror began, he invoked a historical starting point for what he views as the West's oppression of the Muslim world. Salim Ali is a Muslim of Pakistani origin, and he says there are some histories better left in the past.
A few miles from Ground Zero in the Museum of Modern Art hangs Salvador Dali's enigmatic painting, The Persistence of Memory. Soon after the tragic events of recent months, I revisited the images of melting clocks that haunt this painting from the years between World War I and World War II. The images brought forth a dissonant realization that so much of the conflict which surrounds us now is steeped in history, or more consequentially, in the memory of past events. Just as the melting clocks depict a caricature of time, protagonists and antagonists in today's conflict are distorting repressed memories to promote their cause. As a Muslim of Pakistani origin, I am particularly troubled by the exploitation of our collective memory. Osama bin Laden's hate-filled speeches have urged Muslims to reflect on 80 years of subjugation since the demise of the Ottoman Caliphate. Not too long ago, Serbian nationalists referred back to the invasion of Balkan lands by the Caliphate in the 17th century to galvanize their armies. Even venerable writers such as the recent recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature, V.S. Naipaul, has succumbed to an atavistic remembrance of pre-Muslim India and Malaya in his controversial book, Beyond Belief. These examples illustrate that the phenomenon is clearly widespread and is reinforced by misplaced exhortations to learn from history, no matter how anachronistic the lessons may be. However, there is a difference between learning from history and being governed by the past. There is an unfortunate victim complex which many communities in America are developing that is fueled by the selective renewal of destructive memories. Despite its many failings, the American system has an admirable ability to learn and change. While some racial tensions continue, the remarkable progress in civil rights for African Americans following the nonviolent struggle of Dr. Martin Luther King is a worthy example in this regard. Those of us who live in America and have benefited from the enormous opportunities which this land has offered us are particularly concerned about the wave of anti-Americanism that is sweeping many Muslim countries. Muslims and our brethren in other communities must unite, but not over past grievances, but rather over a collective future as a global community. I am by no means advocating national amnesia of past injustices. Only a therapeutic reconciliation with the past and the timeless virtue of being able to disagree without being disagreeable.
Salim Ali lives in Mansfield, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. Send your radio diary submissions by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can listen to radio diaries featured on Special Coverage by going to our website, log on to wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
From Boston University, this